I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 219 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.fm, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or other programs. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Now PRN.fm has voicemail, 862-800-6805. And if you leave a message or a question, also leave your name and indicate that the question is for The Infectious Myth. If you dial either of these phone numbers, remember that long-distance charges may apply, especially if you're outside the United States. I don't know that you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, what you like about it, what you'd like me to change. If you include your mailing address, I'll send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. I do really love to hear from my listeners. Don't be shy. You can make a one-time donation to the expenses of the show via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com or make monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you're gleaning, for the support you get for some mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. Maybe one of these days I can even afford to do some advertising on Facebook and Google and other places like that. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on any topic that you think I have an interesting and worthwhile opinion on, I'd be happy to discuss this. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. Time for a little feedback. Derek wrote regarding the Jacob Stigenga interview regarding his book Medical Nihilism, commenting, "The Many Sins of Pharma and the FDA." Indeed. Lawrence via email wrote to add to some of my discussions of vaccination, some of my interviews of vaccination, with a YouTube history of the toilet. I think it was from BBC or somewhere like that. And he noted that this is one of the reasons why health has improved in the era of infectious diseases. Before vaccination, there were dramatic declines of disease, and the toilet, the thing we don't like to talk about or think about, probably had a big impact on that. Regarding William Parker on Tylenol, Jane on Facebook said, "What a great interview. Thanks." Mindy on Facebook, also on vaccines, in response to a Harvard study I posted showing that less than 1% of adverse reactions are reported, "Why is it the average person can't wrap their head around the notion that a drug, a vaccine is a drug, can harm and that there are no studies using an inert placebo proving safety or efficacy?" Now let's talk about diet. Professor Tim Noakes was born in Zimbabwe in 1949. When young, he was very much into sports and still runs regularly today, sometimes half marathons. He obtained an MBCHB degree from the University of Cape Town in South Africa in 1974, an MD in 1981, and a DSC in exercise science in 2002. In the early 1990s, he helped found the Sports Science Institute of South Africa. He retired as professor of exercise and sports science at the University of Cape Town in 2014. And currently holds the title of Professor Emeritus. He wrote the book Lore of Running, spelled L-O-R-E, Rugby Without Risk, co-wrote Art and Science of Cricket, wrote a scientific autobiography, Challenging Beliefs, and also the book Waterlogged about overhydration in endurance sports. Most recently, he published Lore of Nutrition, also L-O-R-E. But what brought him to my attention was an attempt to strike him off the medical register in South Africa because of the dietary advice and his dietary beliefs. Welcome to the show, Dr. Noakes.
Thank you, David. Thank you very much for that kind introduction.
Yes, well, it's great to have you with me today. I hear that in the Southern Hemisphere you're very famous, maybe not so much in the North, but
Yes.
what made you start to think about low carb diets, both from a personal point of view and a scientific point of view?
Well, David, the story was quite simple. When I finished the book Waterlogged and sent it off to the publishers in America, I hadn't been running as much as I used to. And I got fat. Well, I think you probably wouldn't call me fat, but I wasn't as lean as I had been. And my running was disastrous. And in the middle of the night, having now finished this book, which took the research and the book took 30 years total, I woke up in the middle of the night. My brain said, "You must get up at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. You must go for a run," which I did. And it was one of the worst runs of my life. And I realized I was in really bad shape. And I realized I was a little overweight and that I needed to do something about it. And by chance, when I came home and opened my emails, there was an advert for a book called The New Atkins for the New You. And I looked at it, and it was really interesting because it says lose 6 kilograms in 6 weeks without hunger. I said, "Well, that's impossible. You've got to be hungry to lose weight." And then I said, "These guys are obviously frauds because A, they're using Atkins's name," and Atkins was the worst doctor in the world because he told us to eat saturated fat. And I knew, then I looked at the authors at Westman, Voley, and Finnick, and I said, "Now I know Volek and Finney, because they were studying high fat diets in athletes, and they stimulated me to do some research." So we were one of the first groups ever to do studies of high fat diets in athletes after Steve Finney's book work came out. So I said, "These people are an absolute disgrace. I am so angry. I'm going to go and buy this." I got in the car and drove to the bookshop and picked up the book. It was the last copy, and brought it home and started reading immediately because I was red in the face. I was so angry. And then 2 hours later, I started reading and I thought, "Oh my gosh, I got it wrong for 33 years." I said, "Here's the evidence that a low carb diet can be beneficial for your health. It's explained very carefully and very clearly. There's lots of evidence that this is right. They quoted the science." And so I decided, well, I better try. So by lunchtime, I decided I'd eaten my last carbs. And that was December the 12th, 2010. And now we're into 2019, and I'm still on the same diet, and the benefits were absolutely enormous for me.
What did you learn about diet while you were studying? I mean, you studied an MD as well as other degrees. What did you learn about diet in university?
Well, in my medical training, nothing, absolutely nothing. I mean, and that's the reality. However, in 1976, I started studying for my MD, which is a different than in North America. MD is a PhD in medicine in South Africa. So I started doing my PhD, and I was working with a guy called Professor Lionel Opie, and he was one of the world authorities in cardiology. And he was promoting this low-fat, high-grain diet, and no margarine, and lots of margarine and no saturated fat. So I came home one day and told my wife that the food she was eating was killing me, and we had to start eating margarine. So she said, "Sure, you can eat all the margarine you like, but I'm not stopping eating butter."
Sensible woman.
That's right. So we had a bit of a split there, but it was so funny because I was on earlier today. I was doing a Skype with the whole group, and a friend of mine phoned in from Australia, and he reminded me that in 1989 I'd gone to his house and as part of some running race or something, and he'd fed me bacon and eggs in the morning, and I'd thrown it in the dustbin.
Oh,
I
really?
refused to eat it.
So you completely changed your beliefs. You had adopted the low fat diet, and then in 2010 you threw that all out the window and changed. So I was reading somewhere that doctors don't like to deal with diet. They give that to dietitians. So let's say you have a heart attack and they say you need to change your diet. So what are dietitians telling people these days?
Well, dietitians don't, at least in this country, and I'm speaking only for South Africa because I don't know what happens in North America, but these guys, but I suspect it's similar, that they'd have very little training in physiology and biochemistry, and they're taught a rote idea about that you must eat lots of grains. They just follow the dietary guidelines, and they say we're doing evidence-based nutritional advice, and it's all high carbohydrate, it's healthy whole grains and lots of vegetables, lots of fruit, and no saturated fat, no full cream milk, no butter,
right,
and lots of vegetable oils. And that was the diet that I followed. And I must just make the point that on that diet, despite running, I ran 70 marathons and ultra marathons during that time. I still got fat. I still got type 2 diabetes, which is astonishing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm doing exactly what I'm told. I was told this is the diet you meant to eat. I did it. Again, remember I was told by the professor of cardiology at my university, who traveled the world and was looked up at all over the world. And he told me I must eat that diet. And unfortunately I did. And the consequence 33 years later was I had a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. I'm glad to say that on this high fat diet, my diabetes is in remission. It's not cured. I still got diabetes, but at least if you checked me, you wouldn't know that I had diabetes until I start eating carbohydrates. And then the diabetes becomes florid again.
Right. So it's in remission, but if you went back to a high carb diet, you'd be diabetic very quickly again.
Absolutely.
Like an active diabetic.
Absolutely. And one of the points that my experience has been was that we did some experiments on myself. We were studying post-exercise ketosis in 1978. And we published a paper in 1980 in the Journal of Physiology called Post-Exercise Ketosis. And there were two of us who did, the main experiments were on two of us. We were both marathon runners, and we were both lean, and we were both running 140 kilometers, about 70, 80 miles a week. And we were racing marathons. We were in the peak of fitness, and right, we checked our insulin by chance. We had a fasting insulin. Because of the experiment, it was a metabolic experiment. Now, it's very unusual to have a fasting insulin measured in 1978. Very unusual. And when I go back and look at those data, it turns out my fasting insulin was five times the normal value, five times the normal when I ate a high carbohydrate diet. It was still two times normal when I ate the high fat diet. We happened to do a high fat diet as well.
Right.
So I was a sick sitting duck for type 2 diabetes. But the point is, I was healthy as you could be. I was doing all the running, and I was incredibly lean, and yet I was profoundly insulin resistant. And a lot of people confuse it. They think that it's the obesity that causes the problem, the diabetes. Mm-hmm. It's not. It's this genetic condition of insulin resistance, which we all have to some degree. And some worse than others. And I would just happen to be really bad because I've got this terrible family history of diabetes. My dad died of the condition. Mm-hmm. An aunt had the condition. An uncle had the condition. And I don't even know about my grandparents. They might all have had the condition as well. So I was a sitting duck. And it's not because I was fat. It was because I was insulin resistant. And I ate this high carbohydrate diet for 33 years or so.
Right. So when did you start studying high-fat diets in sports? In sports medicine,
well,
in your area?
You know, in 1984, that's interesting. Now I'm going to tell you a really funny story.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1984, Steve Finney publishes the first study of high-fat diets in athletes. And he does it because he reads an article, a book, which written by one of the famous American explorers who went to the Canadian Arctic to try to find the Franklin Expedition. Mm-hmm. The Franklin Expedition was a famous boat trying to find the Northwest Passage, and about 150 sailors, and they all died, and they just disappeared off the face of the earth.
They just recently found their boats, actually.
That's correct. Absolutely correct. And it's Canadian, of course.
Yes.
It's Canadian.
So I know all about that.
So anyway, one of the first guys to actually get far enough north and to find remnants and dead bodies and skeletons and so on,
right,
wrote a book of his experience. And there he says, for the first 2 weeks, because he went with the Inuit.
Inuit, right.
He said, for the first 2 weeks, I could hardly do any exercise, but then I adapted, and then I could keep up with them eating their diet. And so Finney said, gosh, there you have, maybe you can adapt to this diet. And so he did the first study. Now, one of the first people to read that study by chance was a lady called Paula Newby-Fraser, who I'd been helping train for the Hawaiian Ironman triathlon. Mm-hmm. And she phoned me and she said, Tim, I've read this work. Do you think I should eat a higher fat diet? I said, it's absolutely logical for the Ironman triathlon. I think you should do it. She then became the greatest triathlete of all time. She won 8 Ironman triathlons, Hawaiian Ironman triathlons. So she won the world championships 8 times. She won 28 Ironman championships around the globe.
Right.
And when she retired, she came to me and she said, Tim, the advice you gave me was the most important piece of information I received in my entire career. So I said, hold it, Paula. I never told you to go low carb. She said, doesn't matter. I did. she went low carb. And I said, well, just eat a little more fat. But of course, I didn't realize that meant you had to cut the carbs.
So she interpreted your advice maybe differently than you intended it to be.
Exactly. Because at that very time, at that very moment, I was writing The Law of Running. And there it says, eat a high carbohydrate diet.
Oh, really? Yeah. So is it... can you explain what ketosis is? Because people are talking a lot about the keto diet now, and I'm not entirely sure what ketosis is.
Yeah.
I'm sure most people aren't.
Yeah, so it's interesting because if you go back to 1978, no one did, because what we were researching was a paper written in the 1930s talking about ketosis. And they hadn't worked out really what caused it. And I knew from the low carb diet that we ate before we ran marathons, for 3 days we'd eat no carbs and we'd become ketotic, and we could tell that because our breath started to smell. And so I was pretty sure that carbs were linked to low carb diets were linked to ketosis, and that's the experiment we did. And we showed that if we ate a low carbohydrate diet for 3 days and then we ran for 2 hours in the morning, we could increase our ketones dramatically from about 0.3 units up to 3 units, so that they went up tenfold in 2 hours just by running on this low carb diet.
And what's the benefit of higher ketones?
Well, it's a marker that you're burning fat and not carbohydrates. Okay. So that's what it really is. But what people are realizing that ketones actually have a wide range of beneficial effects throughout the body. So what happens then? If you starve yourself or you eat a low carbohydrate diet, the body has to produce something to take the place of burning glucose, because glucose is now not available if you're fasting or eating a low carbohydrate diet. And in the course of evolution, and I don't know how far back which animals first show it, we developed this ability to produce ketones. So as you cut your carbohydrates, the fat cells in the periphery start to release fat, and the fat comes to the liver in more and more higher concentrations, and the liver converts it to these ketone bodies, which are amazing because they're water soluble, so they don't have to be carried with anything. So they can travel very easily, and they can cross the brain, and they can get into the brain, and they can provide energy instead of glucose. But more importantly, they seem to have a regulatory function and also other functions. For example, there's a paper at the American Heart Association this year, or one of the heart associations, showing that ketone bodies can help people get out of heart failure. So it looks like the heart also likes to burn ketones in preference to glucose. So there are all sorts of interesting findings about the value of ketones. But the main point is, if you're ketotic, it shows your body is burning fat rather than carbohydrate.
Right.
And we believe that that's more beneficial because you've got if you're an athlete, you've got much more fat in the body. So if you're burning fat, you're going to last longer. And secondly, it tells us that your blood insulin concentration is low. And we're beginning to think that the real killer is not cholesterol. It's having a high insulin all the time from eating lots of carbohydrate.
Right. But you need carbohydrates to make fat, right?
No, you don't. Let me put it this way. The fat that you that store in your body is actually from the fat in the diet. So that's what you use. You convert carbohydrate to fat in the liver. That is correct. That's absolutely correct. But the main source of fat in the body is actually fat that you ingest.
Okay. So are you saying that you could go on a low or zero carbohydrate diet for an extended period of time, or do you need to sometimes eat carbohydrates?
No, the reason and the solution is that you have a liver, and the liver can generate as much carbohydrate as you need for, once you start carbohydrate depleting yourself. So, and we have published papers on that your glucose control in the bloodstream is perfectly normal in people who are on this diet. Mm-hmm. So the point is that the liver will take up the slack. So if you reduce your carbohydrate intake dramatically, the liver will simply produce enough glucose. But the key is that you just stop using glucose. The muscles no longer use glucose, and the brain reduces its glucose consumption. So you need much less glucose. And that's the way you actually balance it out. You stop using as much glucose so that the liver just continues to put out the same amount of glucose. But it's more than enough to cover because you've reduced your use.
Okay, we've probably had a half a century of advice from all the best medical authorities, as you used to give, that people need to eat a low-fat diet, especially low in saturated fats, and that carbs are good if you eat good carbs, like whole grains as opposed to, you know, highly processed grains and sugar. So if this is wrong, how did dietary advice go off the rails so badly back in, I don't know, the 50s or whenever it started?
So let me make the point that the diet you're prescribing there is fine for about 20% of the United States, of the North American population, 20%. And the other 80%, it's a disaster. And I happen to fall in the other 80%. And the people who are promoting that diet fall in the 20% who can eat that diet. Mm-hmm. And if you can stay healthy and lean on the diet of high carbohydrate diet, you will never understand what it is like to eat that diet and get fat and sick because it didn't happen to you. So what you say is, you see, Dr. Noakes got fat because he was lazy and he did something wrong. He just ate too much and he was lazy. And that's not true, mm-hmm. because I lost 4 pounds in the first week of converting to this diet.
Right.
So how did I suddenly not become lazy in 7 days?
And you were running like ultra marathons, which doesn't sound like the definition of lazy.
Exactly. So the big problem is that the diet works for 20% of the population. And it turns out that those people just don't understand. They can't understand what we're talking about. But if you're on my side and you were once fat and now you're lean without any trouble, you suddenly understand the problem. So, but what happened was in 1953, a guy called Ansel Keys got it in his head that saturated fat was causing heart disease. And then he sold that to the American Heart Association, mm-hmm. who bought in. And they said, we must start eating polyunsaturated fats. And it turns out that polyunsaturated fats are so-called vegetable oils. And there were many companies in North America who were pushing vegetable oils. So they jumped on the bandwagon and they funded the American Heart Association, which now had lots of money and was able to push the message out that saturated fat was killing you and you must replace it with vegetable oils. So that went on right through till 1977, when the United States Department of Agriculture, the United States Department of Agriculture, notice, whose responsibility is to sell food, not to make you healthy, produce new guidelines, and they put the grains and cereals and said we must eat 7 to 11 servings each day of grains and cereals. And there was no evidence for that. We actually show that in my most recent book, Law of Nutrition. You can see there was not one strand of evidence. And this experiment, which was taken across the world, although of course the North Americans were the first to be exposed to this because their government made the guidelines, the rest of the world followed suit. So it was this global experiment and it failed. And there was never any evidence that we should change. And the problem is, once you get that far, that governments are behind it, and the top scientists have put their names to it, it's very difficult for anyone to change and to say, gosh, we got it all wrong. And that's where we're in the moment.
Right. It seems to me that there's some shift been happening in the past few years. Like there was recently an article or a paper about how the sugar manufacturers were involved with this, you know, low-fat diet craze to try to shift the blame for heart disease from sugar to fat. So there appears to be some opening. I mean, do you still think there's an iron grip or things?
No. The problem is that it turns out the key drivers of the dietary guidelines have been the Seventh-day Adventists, which is astonishing. And my friend of mine,
yes,
Gary Fetke. So the guidelines became a religion, and that's what drove it. The first dietary guidelines were drawn up actually in 1917, and eight of the nine people who drew them up were Seventh-day Adventists. And so they pushed the plant-based diets because they are vegetarian predominantly. And that influence has stayed ever since. So and the Kellogg, move towards a plant-based diet.
Kellogg, for example, was a Seventh-day Adventist, right?
That's correct. Absolutely correct. And so that, and the problem is that the dietary guidelines, which are being drawn up today, 2020, there will be a small shift, but the committee has been carefully selected, and it still includes people who are influenced by the Seventh-day Adventists. And so it's still going to be plant-based, and it's still going to say that you can eat a bit more fat, but saturated fat's going to kill you. And why is that? Because saturated fat comes from animals, and animals are bad for us, et cetera, and there's environmental effects and so on. So there will be a small shift, but it won't be what we need. We need a revolution. What the American Diabetes Association have done is they've acknowledged that the low carbohydrate diet is the best way to treat diabetes. Mm-hmm. And how they got around it, they've said, oh, you see, diabetics are different from normal people, and this is medical therapy. So you can use a low carbohydrate diet for medical therapy if you have a diagnosis of diabetes, but telling the rest of the world to eat a low carbohydrate, that's still not good because that's potentially dangerous. Harmful. So they've got around it that way.
Oh, okay. Another thing that seems to have shifted is there's a lot more, a vegan diet is a lot more popular.
Yeah.
And yeah. Of course, the vegans are utterly opposed to any diet that contains meat. So the reason seems to be shifting from, you know, a low-fat diet is good for you, to a low-fat diet is good for the planet. You're not killing animals. You're not causing, you know, using fertilizers to grow animals, etc.
Yeah, we won't talk about fertilizers because that's where the vegan argument falls down completely. But anyway, you're quite right. And what's happened is that big food has now got behind the vegan movement because they realize they can make even more money. Because what's happened to them is that the grains have been, people are realizing grains aren't the best for us. So now they're going to hide it with soy. They're going to put the protein for the vegan products is come from soy and lots of vegetable oils and lots of sugar. Processed, and they can charge the earth for it. So these so-called fake burgers cost about four times the cost of normal meat, which is fantastic for these people because now they're making a product on which the markup is enormous. So they're driving it as well.
Do you have information
for the people
on the health of vegans? Because they say we're way healthier than average people.
Well, any group who have more on the earth and planet than vegans are ex-vegans. So the question is, if it's such a healthy diet, why are there any ex-vegans? You'd think that everyone would want to eat this diet that's making you so healthy. And the reality is it isn't. It's a disaster. It's very difficult to stay healthy on a plant-based diet. And I even contest that those people who claim they're on a vegan diet and claim that they are healthy, if they were properly examined, you might find some really disturbing findings. For example, vitamin B12 deficiency is rampant amongst vegans. And you need B12 for your brain function and to prevent dementia. Mm-hmm. And that if I was a vegan, I would be looking seriously at the issues of dementia, because the first vegans are now approaching 70.
Right.
And so now those are the ones who, if they're going to get dementia, it's going to appear in this group. Mm-hmm. It's like I belong to the first generation, well, not the first, probably the second generation of people who did an enormous amount of running. And so we discovered that your arthritis rate goes up.
Right.
If you've been running all these years. Whereas if you read my book, Law of Running, it says arthritis doesn't happen in runners. Well, that's nonsense, unfortunately, because we were still before the period that we've got now, where we've got tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or even millions of people who run for 30 or 40 years at quite a high level. Mm-hmm. And they've continued, and they're worn out. The joints are worn out. So now I have to change the book. And so the warning symptom for vegans is dementia,
mm-hmm.
because you can't, that diet is completely brain unfriendly. And so again, people say to me, but Dr. Noakes, your diet's going to cause me to have a heart attack at 40 or 50. I'll say, fine, well, let's look at it. Let's see what your heart function is. But there's no marker of pre-dementia. You can't tell who's going to get demented. So all we can do is sit and watch.
Right.
And again, my point is, if I was a vegan or a vegetarian, a very strict vegetarian, I would be watching for evidence that dementia is going to be more prevalent in the group.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that assumes that you have an open mind and you're interested in it. I don't detect from, like, veganism is a philosophical position.
Yeah.
And it's very hard if you're a vegan to say, well, maybe there are some issues with my diet. You know, maybe
yeah.
It'd be hard to see a true diet in the world vegan, you know, looking at their own diet skeptically.
Yeah, no, that's right. It's a religion and it's a cult. So that's fine. It's what they accused us in the low carb diet of being a cult. But the reality is, if you understand the biology and the physiology, there's a very good reason for people with insulin resistance to eat this diet, because it's clear that's the only way you can survive. If you are insulin resistant and you eat the standard low fat diet, you're in trouble. You will develop conditions. And the only hope for us is to eat a low carb diet. And the evidence is clear. So I was debating this with a guy this morning, and he said, but what about in 40 years' time? I said, well, we're all going to die. Mm-hmm. But all I know is that my diabetes is under control. Whereas if it hadn't been under control, it's been under control now for 7-8 years. My father died 10 years after the diagnosis. I should be now presenting with advanced stages of the symptoms of diabetes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I should have renal failure. Maybe my eyesight's gone. Maybe my peripheral vessels are closing up and I get gangrene.
Yes.
But I don't get to see that. So I have to conclude that what I'm doing is delaying that. I'm not saying it's never going to happen, but at least I'm delaying it beyond the normal range if I continued to eat the other diet that was killing me in the first place.
Right. A few years ago, I learned that the husband of a friend of mine made prosthetics, and being kind of an anti-war guy, I sort of said, well, are these for soldiers, industrial accidents, things like that? And she said, no, most of them are for diabetics.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Because
there was a report in South Africa. Now, remember, we're a small country. And in one of the states, they were reporting 2,500 amputations a year, which comes down to about 6 a day. And they said, this is catastrophic. And that's just the beginning. Because I can tell you that those people, once you have an amputation, you've probably got a year's life expectancy left, because it's really the end stage of mm-hmm. arterial disease, which is the problem in diabetes.
Right.
And that's, people aren't recognizing it, that this is the next disaster that's facing us.
I want to shift to a debate that happened and some of the events that happened after that. In December 2014 at the University of Cape Town, you had a debate with a former colleague, Professor Russo.
Yeah, that's right.
So explain that debate, and then we'll talk about the Health Professions Council of South Africa, which came a little bit afterwards, I think.
Yeah, so what I didn't know at that time was that I clearly antagonized my whole profession in South Africa, and that they were ganging up on me to try to expose me. And the first problem we did was that I wrote a book called Challenging Beliefs, which you mentioned, and then I described my conversion, and I said how the statin drugs, I said the cholesterol doesn't cause heart disease, and here's the evidence, and the statin drugs don't really help. And that caused a real furor because of my, I'm quite well known in South Africa. Here was a guy standing up and saying that, standing up against the pharmaceutical industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a lot of unhappiness going on behind the scenes, and they had to work out a way to silence me. And this was the, my university was hoping that this debate with Rousseau would shut me up completely. He would publicly humiliate me, and that would be the end of the debate. So Noakes would be exposed. The problem was I held my own. I didn't win that. I didn't win, but in a highly antagonistic group, I managed to present enough science that they couldn't say I'd completely lost the debate. And so that was the first thing. That was in, as you said, that was in 2012.
I thought it was 2014.
That was 2014.
Right.
Talking
about a different.
That was 2012.
Okay, 2012.
Because then in 2013, I wrote the book Real Meal Revolution. And all I did was I wrote a chapter. And this book then became an incredibly successful seller. It was one of the best-selling books ever in the history of South Africa. And it changed the diet debate because now people would say, but here, look at all this evidence that a low-carbohydrate diet may be very good for you and a low-fat diet may not be healthy. And the dietitians couldn't answer it. And the book sold so much that it impacted, in my view, on the dietetics practice in this country. And so the dietitians decided they had to shut me up as well. So they went to the Health Professionals Council and they said, Noakes is demeaning the profession. We've got to take him out.
Mm-hmm.
And they were then discussing ways to do it. And then they found my Twitter account and they found this single tweet.
And
they decided that was evidence for bad conduct by a physician. And so then they charged me with it.
Right, but and I believe that the tweet was saying that the good first foods for infant weaning are low carb, high fat.
That's correct.
Fish, chicken, yeah. Eggs, dairy, and vegetables. And that that's was correct. Enough to initiate proceedings against you.
Yeah. So what happened then, because the whole thing was so corrupted, I didn't get my due process. So what should happen is when a complaint is sent in,
mm-hmm.
A committee meets, and then the committee calls you in and says, Professor Noakes, we've got this complaint. Can we discuss it? Let's decide what we need to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was never given that right. Instead, what they did was they said, but actually, there's no evidence whether he's right or wrong. Let's go and collect some more evidence. And they involved my own university in it. And the university professors wrote a letter to the local newspaper complaining about how the science I was doing was wrong and what I was promoting was completely wrong, and it was damaging the health of all South Africans, and the university completely dissociates itself from me. So that was the one bit of evidence which now went before the committee. And the other bit was a paper that had been being developed by local university people at the University of Stellenbosch, which was a meta-analysis of supposedly low carbohydrate diets.
Mm-hmm.
And this was delayed for about a year. They warned us it was coming, but eventually it came out just before I was charged.
Mm-hmm.
And with those two pieces of information, which I was never allowed to see or contest, I was charged. So the committee completely broke the South African law by charging me without telling me A, what I was being charged for, and B, here was the evidence, and giving me an opportunity. So obviously I took this very seriously, and fortunately I found the two of the best lawyers in South Africa came on board and they said, we'll defend you for free. So now we had a little bit more money. We could spend it and we weren't so pressurized to get the trial over as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided we're just going to put the low-carb diet on trial. Not me on trial, the low-carb diet on trial. And we presented 12 days of evidence under cross-examination. I was cross-examined for 3.5 days.
Wow.
And my expert witnesses were also cross-examined for at least a day. They gave 3 days of testimony. And we presented 6,000 pages of scientific research to support the low carbohydrate diet. The mm-hmm. prosecution presented one paper. That was their whole evidence base. And it was this meta-analysis, which we subsequently discovered is dubious. There are a whole bunch of errors in it, and which we pointed out in the medical literature.
Let's talk about that a little bit because it's interesting. So it's a meta-analysis of low-carb diets, so the kind of diets that you promote. And I assume from the fact it was submitted as evidence that it concludes that there's problems with low-carb diets.
Well, there were two problems. The firstly was it was not a low-carbohydrate diet. It had nothing to do with the diet I was proposing. The lowest percentage carbohydrate on the diet was about 30%. We talk about a 5 to 10% diet. Mm-hmm. So this was a high carbohydrate diet in our words. Point one and point two, they only use what we call isoenergetic trials, where the people eating the higher fat diet and the people eating the higher carbohydrate diet, they were both eating the same number of calories. And that is biased against the low carb diet, because the key to the low carb diet, it takes away your hunger. So you can eat less calories and feel full.
Right.
So the whole point about why you lose weight on the low-carb diet is because you eat fewer calories because you're satiated. So they obliterated that benefit. So they looked very selectively at this group of studies. And at the end of the day, there was no difference between the studies in anything, in between the low-carb and the so-called high-carb diets. There was no difference whatsoever, except for weight loss. And the weight loss was on the verge, almost proving that the low-carb diet, which of course to me was a high-carb diet, but then the low-carb diet, i.e. the diet we were proposing, the weight loss was greater on that diet, and it was almost significant. It was on the borderline significance. And we showed that there were 14 material errors in the way they had drawn up the analysis, particularly for weight loss. Mm-hmm. And if one or two of them were corrected for, the weight loss was greater in the low carb group. So the lower carb group.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So even though they tried to bias it everything against the lower carbohydrate diet, the lower carbohydrate diet stood its ground and was almost different. Almost different. And when we redid the analysis, when according to what we thought should have been the way the analysis was done, the lower carb diet won. Now, of course, that would have been catastrophic for them, because if that had come out at the time of before I was charged, they would have had to say, well, actually, Noakes is right. The lower carbohydrate diet produces more weight loss, so we can't charge him. So that was
another approach that they could have taken. And I don't know if they took this. I mean, given that you were talking about infants, you know, people are easily manipulated because everybody wants babies to be healthy, right? So So they could have said, you know, it's dangerous in some way. Infants aren't going to grow properly and they aren't going to put on weight, things like that. I mean, did that come up, sort of infant-specific stuff, or was it really general?
Yeah, well, that actually was the charge. The charge was that I was promoting, you know, this unconventional diet to a breastfeeding mother, which was all wrong. The charge is completely wrong, as we showed. But you're quite right. But you see, they couldn't produce any evidence because there is no evidence. All the evidence is that if you have children who are being raised on a mainly cereal-based diet, which is what the average South African is.
Right.
Remember that South Africa is a population of 50 million, and we don't live all in the cities. There are many people living in the rural areas living on maize. That is their basic food.
Mm-hmm.
And the irony was that the lady who drew up the dietary guidelines for South Africa was the chief witness for the prosecution, and she didn't even know what the dietary guidelines were for children. When we charged her, we said, but you haven't even got guidelines for people between 6 months and 12 months. There's no saying here you must eat a high carbohydrate diet. So she said, no, but why would we need that, because we know all South Africans eat a high carbohydrate diet. And that was the whole point, because our argument is that if you feed children a high carbohydrate diet between 6 months and 12 months, you're impacting on their future health for life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they need lots of animal protein. And the evidence is abundantly clear. And that's why the guidelines say in every poorer community, the more animal protein that children can eat between the ages of 6 months and 12 months, the better their health, the better their mental development, the better their growth. Everything benefits. So they couldn't argue that because the evidence is absolutely the opposite of what they what they say. And our argument was that what you are doing is you're forcing South Africans to eat a poor diet, a poor person's diet. And that is a disadvantaging a large percentage of South Africans because they're raised on maize when they should be raised on other things.
Let's talk about some details of the keto diet. Perhaps you can describe how it differs from the Atkins diet, which influenced you. People talk about the paleo diet. Apparently in South Africa, a Banting diet is also quite popular, and I believe that also influenced you. So these are all low-carb diets, as far as I know. So how do they differ? Great. And what is it that you're promoting that's a little bit different than some of these other low-carb diets?
Yeah, well, Atkins, interestingly, discovered the low-carb diet because he was fat at the time of Kennedy's assassination, President John F. Kennedy's assassination. And he was watching on television what was going on, and he was so depressed, and he was overweight, and he was a doctor, an intern. He said, I've got to do something about my weight. But he said, I've got to have something that will take away my hunger. And he read the literature which showed that ketosis reduces hunger. So he said, okay, what's a ketogenic diet? And he found it was a low-carb diet. So the Atkins diet was actually ketogenic, but he never used the term. He just became known as the Atkins diet, which then became known as sort of a high-saturated fat diet, which is not necessarily the case.
And everybody notes that Atkins died of a heart attack.
Which he didn't actually. He died. He had heart failure from a viral infection, and he fell and hit his head and died of a brain hemorrhage. That's what he eventually died of. But that, again, the vegan misinformation came out. His wife is on the internet as saying he died from the trauma to his brain. But be that as it may, you know, he was a complex guy, and I don't think he made it very. He could have made it easier for all of us. Right. But what he did was he funded Westman, Volek, and Finney, who did the research, which showed that the diet works. And without that evidence, I couldn't have won my case because they provided the beginning research showing that this diet is safe. Right. So that's the Atkins diet. The Banting diet is simply a low-carbohydrate diet, which we renamed after William Banting, who was the first person to describe the diet in 1862. And what we were trying to make the point is that how can a diet be a fad diet if it was the original obesity-reducing diet in 1862, it can't be the fad diet. So that's why we use the term Banting. But Banting and Atkins and low-carb, they're all pretty much the same. The only thing that's different, paleo doesn't allow milk because it says humans were not eating milk in the Paleolithic period, which is before 14 to 18,000 years before present. So that's the only way the paleo diet tends to have a bit more carbohydrate in it. And I just say, listen, it depends how insulin resistant you are. If you're insulin resistant type 2 diabetes like myself, you must eat 25 grams of carbs a day. That's it. Which means you must restrict everything. You can only eat a little bit of vegetables. All the rest is out.
Yeah, because even vegetables, which obviously are necessary, there are very few that don't have some. I mean, they all have carbohydrates in them, right?
That's correct. So the only carbohydrate I could eat is vegetables. That's correct.
Is this Banting the same as Banting and Best, the insulin?
No. Banting and Best were the guys who discovered insulin. That's correct. And there probably is a relationship if you went back. And I think people are trying to look into that. But William Banting was an obese Englishman. He was the person who provided the funeral services to all the kings and queens of England. So he was a very wealthy man, very well known. And he was fat and he tried everything. He literally, for 30 years, he tried to lose weight. Nothing worked. And then all of a sudden, he was given a low-carb diet and dramatically he lost 40 pounds. And he said that this was the solution. And then he wrote a book. And that book is still available. And it's called Letters on Corpulence. And it's, as I said, you can download it on the internet. And that became the most famous early diet book and went across to the United States. It went to North America. It went to Europe. And it was a standard treatment for obesity up till about 1950 or so. After the Second World War, suddenly everyone gets clever and they start talking about calories in, calories out, and it doesn't matter what calories you eat. Right. Can be fat, carbohydrate. As long as you don't eat too many calories, you won't get fat. And that's when we start to get fat, when we change from our understanding that carbohydrates have got something to do with obesity to saying, no, the carbohydrates don't matter. They were health washed. Carbohydrates became health washed after 1950. And then that was part of the problem.
On your Twitter feed, which is pretty active, somebody who was a vegan recently said, people on the low-carb, high-fat diet die at a 30% higher rate. Do you know what she's referring to and why you disagree with that? Well, I assume you do.
Well, there's no evidence for that. I mean, that's... Firstly, how do we identify a population eating low-carb diets? Firstly, step point one. Point two, there's no long-term low-carb studies. So for her to make that statement, we need a randomized control trial. Oh. Which got to go for 20 or 30 years, and that study's not been done, so she can't say that.
And it would be very difficult, because like if you put people on a low-carb diet, what would stop them from stopping for a piece of cake every once in a while, right? Like, it'd be very hard to get random people, you know, some people who are on the high-carb arm might decide that it's not working for them, so it'd be very difficult to keep people on a diet for that long.
No, that's precisely, and you'll always revert back to what the standard diet is, and that's one of the problems, because you know I get information from people on this diet and they tell me they've lost 200 pounds on it, 100 pounds. One guy lost 160 pounds in 28 weeks. I mean, it's just astonishing.
We're starting to run out of time, so I just like to give you the opportunity.
Those people can never stop the eating carbs. They may stop for 3 months or 4 months, but by the time the trial ends at a year, they're back on their sugars. And so therefore their weight goes back to what it was. And so the weight loss is grossly underestimated in laboratory studies.
Mm. Are there any final words you'd like to add since we are coming to the end of our time?
Well, just to thank you, but just to say that, you know, when I started this in 2010, I had no idea where it was going to lead me. Mm-hmm. But it's also very clear that my whole life and career in medicine was leading to this. And I'm very glad that I've done what I've done. I think that there is going to be a major change, and the majority of people will eventually realize that we've been completely misled. And we've been forced to eat we've been encouraged to eat the wrong foods. And the effects have been catastrophic for our health. You know, this is the diabetes obesity epidemic is the only one where man made that epidemic. Every other epidemic that's happened wasn't caused by man, but man caused this one. And man must prevent it. And I'm very proud to be one of the people who's trying to open people's eyes to see that we've been lied to for 50 years. It's time to put the lies aside and look after yourself. So I'm currently writing a book along those lines. And I think this is the final point, that medicine cannot make you healthy. You cannot medicate health. Mm-hmm. So if you think that it doesn't really matter, what I eat doesn't really matter, and the fact that I'm a little diabetic doesn't matter because I'm only 50, and if I get diabetes at 60, it doesn't matter. If you get diabetes at 60 and you continue, you're going to be dead at 70. Mm-hmm. So people mustn't think that you can go and allow medicine to take the responsibility for your health when we're talking about these chronic diseases. There's only one person who's accountable. There's only one person who suffers, and it's you. And so you have to decide. When I'm saying you, I mean all of us. We all have to decide, how do we want to die? And if we want to die in a healthy way and wake up dead in the bed, you better look after your health and sustain it till you're 70 or 80 or 90.
Yes, because obviously humans can live healthy lives well into their 80s, still being active, still enjoying life. And, you know, hopefully one day you just don't wake up. Nothing, you know, like spending a year in a hospital with an increasingly lower quality of life.
That's exactly right.
And a final.
Carry on.
Yeah, so a final question is: you've not just questioned the diet; you've also mentioned cholesterol and statins. I mean, has your attitude towards medicine changed? I mean, you just said that medicine can't make you healthy. I mean, have you sort of become a lot more skeptical about a lot of areas of medicine?
Yeah, essentially, I don't trust any of the scientific research that's being put out at the moment, particularly as it relates to diets. It's astonishing how it's been distorted by industry. Industry now controls everything. So, you see, what I didn't understand until I started on this diet was that 85% of chronic disease, sorry, that 85% of chronic disease is caused by what you're eating. Mm-hmm. And whether you're sleeping and a few other things, and whether you're exercising. But you got to get the diet right first, and then everything else follows. And thinking that you can treat that 85% of chronic diseases with medication, it doesn't work, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So this is a whole new ball game for medicine. And it means you have to divorce yourself from the pharmaceutical industry. And medicine can't do that as yet. And that's a real challenge for our profession.
Well, if humans have an addiction to sugar, doctors have an addiction to the pharmaceutical industry.
That's absolutely correct. And so when you say, is my view of the profession different? It is. I understand that medicine is a business, and a business only thrives if you've got customers. And you only get customers if you've got sick people. So medicine's goal is to keep you sick, or make you believe you're sick. So we have diseases like high cholesterol. There is no such disease as high cholesterol. Mm-hmm. Or we have high blood pressure, which is a disease because it does predispose to certain things.
Right.
And that's how we capture patients. And my point, unfortunately, don't think that medicine's going to save you. Medicine are not going to save you. The only thing that's going to save you is what you do for yourself.
Well, that's a good way to end. A good point to end on. So thank you very much for joining me today, Professor Noakes. I appreciate the discussion a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you for being such an excellent interviewer. I really appreciated being with you.
Okay. And I will send you a link to the podcast afterwards if you want to post it later.
I would love to. Thank you very much. Thanks, David.
Okay. Goodbye then.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 219 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, a question, or a suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or join the discussion there. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you. And goodbye.